I've got the pianist Sarah Cahill here. Folks might remember Sarah from a few years back. She came to Bowling Green State University to perform from her project, her ongoing project, I should say, The Future is Female. And Sarah is here with me. Hello, Sarah.
Hi, Brad. It's wonderful to talk with you again.
We are going to talk about Volume 2 of The Future is Female. This is a recording. It's subtitled The Dance, and it's just come out from First Hand Records. So first of all, why don't you start, Sarah, by telling us about this project, The Future is Female, because you've been working on this for some time, huh?
I have. So I began this project several years ago because we have the classical canon that we all grow up with that's given to us by our music teachers, and we hear these works in the concert halls, and we read about them in textbooks, and we hear them on the radio. And I started to realize there's this whole alternative history of music which needs digging up and researching and discovering. And so I started doing research and talking to other pianists and colleagues and composers, and I had worked with a number of women composers like Pauline Oliveras and Danae Lockwood and Tanya Leon for quite a while, and Ursula Mamlock and others. But I was really curious about composers around the world, and you know, starting in the Baroque when keyboard music started becoming better, I mean, more prevalent. So going back to Elizabeth Jacquet de la Guerre, and she wrote her Pièce de Clavecin in 1687. And that was kind of my mission, and to bring these, you know, attempt to bring these works to life, and also commission new works for this project.
Yeah, you mentioned the new works that you've composed, and you have them in juxtaposition here with works by, as you mentioned, Elizabeth Jacquet de la Guerre, also Clara Schumann, Germaine Taillefer, who's a favorite of mine. Maybe you can talk a little bit about some particular commissions that stand out on this album.
Yeah, I mean, the only piece that I commission on this album is Teresa Wong, who was a Bay Area composer, cellist, and vocalist. Really amazing. She's always doing amazing work. It's called She Dances Naked Under Palm Trees. And she was inspired by Nina Simone's song Images, which is based on a poem by Harlem Renaissance poet William Waring Cooney. And so Teresa takes Nina Simone's a cappella song and sets the melody, and it's very, very powerful. And she also investigates the number 13, which she says, you know, is we're taught that it's an unlucky number, but if you go back in history, it's kind of attached to the notion of the goddess, and there are it's a whole story about the number 13, and you can read her notes about it, but it's so she uses a lot the time signature 13-8, and she does various effects on the piano, and it's just a beautiful piece. But there are other pieces I commissioned for this project, which are on Volume 1, Mary D. Watkins, who's an Oakland composer. This is Volume 1, which came out last March. Mary Watkins is just a tremendous composer, brilliant jazz pianist, and I encourage people to look her up on YouTube and watch her playing. I mean, she's fabulous. She's in her 80s. Just wrote an opera recently about Emmett Till. And so she wrote a piece, I commissioned this piece from her called Summer Days. And this was just in 2020, she wrote this piece. So I recorded, it was important to me to record new work along with, you know, from the Baroque to the present day. and include new work and show that, you know, highlight composers writing today.
So your recordings kind of paint a trajectory of these composers. I mean, what is the difference in the role of a composer, say, of the 17th or 18th centuries, or even the 19th century with Clara Schumann, compared to the crop of female composers today? I mean, obviously, there are more opportunities now than there were hundreds of years ago.
Right. I mean, I think what's really interesting to me, and it's wonderful that there are more resources and more books now about female composers and in history. What's kind of amazing is that it seems like in the Baroque era, there were women composers who did have many opportunities and got their music published. I mean, like Elizabeth Jacquet de la Guerre, her music was published. And her two books of pièces de clavecin. But then you get to the Romantic era and things changed a lot with women. And you think of history as being sort of making progress, right? I mean, that it would be harder in the 17th century than it would be in the 19th century. But in fact, it's the other way around. So that for Clara Schumann and Fanny Mendelssohn, I think things were more difficult than many Baroque composers because, especially sort of upper class women like Fanny Mendelssohn, who was told from a young age that she had to be ladylike, she had to keep her home, she had domestic responsibilities. So her father made it very clear that her brother Felix Mendelssohn could become, you know, could do whatever he wanted and could become a great composer and publish and write all the music he wanted, and that Fanny Mendelssohn could maybe write some music in her free time, but that she, her real responsibility was to take care of the house and get married and have children, and, you know, that was what it was about. So, I mean, that to me is fascinating, that that is kind of harder for women in the 19th century, but an early 20th century. I mean, Germaine Taillefer, her father told her that being a composer was equal to being a prostitute for a woman, that it was just, you know, there was this idea of going into the arts as a kind of prostitution or sort of radical liberal idea or something. You know, but but in the Baroque, it was somehow easier.
That's a really interesting point that you make. And talking about Fanny Mendelssohn, you know, some of her music was passed off on her brother's name. And let's talk about Clara Schumann for a minute, because she was just a remarkable figure in the history of classical music. And I'm struck by the piece that you have on this recording, her variations on a theme of Robert Schumann. That was her husband, of course, who kind of overshadowed her as a musician throughout her life. But she was also like taking care of kids and taking care of the house and doing all those domestic duties while still performing on the piano, still composing occasionally, being a mentor to Johannes Brahms. I mean, that's a whole another story right there, that little trio. But I'm curious why you chose this particular piece of Clara's.
Yeah, so it's the Variations, her Variations Opus 20, which is based on a theme by Robert Schumann. And this was one of the last pieces that she would write because he died in his 40s soon afterwards. And then she supported her 10 children, 8 children. Yeah. She supported all her children by being a professional pianist, which, you know, nowadays we think, how is that? How did that work?
How does that work?
but she did that. And I mean, one interesting thing about Clara Schumann is that her father, Frederick Wieck, encouraged her to compose, and she was a prodigy in her youth as a composer and pianist, and, you know, just astonishing talent in both worlds. But I think, like a lot of women, she made the very conscious decision to support her husband, and that it was her husband who was the great talent, and so she should look up to him and spend her life advocating for his music rather than her own. And that, as it often is in a marriage, one person overshadows the other person to such an extent that all the attention is on that one person. I mean, I'm nothing against Robert Schumann, because of course he was a genius and one of the great composers of all time, but that Clara Schumann just subjugated her own compositional talents in favor of him. So this was a birthday gift for him, and it was the last birthday he would spend with his family before he was, you know, his suicide attempt, jumping into the Rhine River, and then being put into a mental asylum. And the tragic thing about that, of course, is that Clara Schumann wasn't allowed to visit him because the doctors thought that it would be too emotional for Robert Schumann to see his wife. And so they kept them apart. I mean, these two soulmates were really kept apart. And Brahms would go visit Robert Schumann and then report back to Clara Schumann to sort of be a go-between. But really tragic story. And I think it comes through in these variations. I mean, it's very poignant because she's paying homage to her husband in the same way that he paid homage to her when she was a young composer, and he would take her themes and use them in music. And, you know, famously, she wrote a mazurka that became the beginning of Dabitzbündler Tänze. It's like dun da da dun dun da da dum. You know, and that was written by Clara Schumann, but everybody thinks it's Robert Schumann. So it's just an incredible story. I mean, that they had these musical codes between them, and so this was sort of her musical code. It's a really beautiful and poignant piece and says so much about their relationship.
So many different stories involved in these pieces of music. I mean, the music is just sort of the starting point for people that want to dig into this recording. How did you come to assemble these three different programs? I mean, for record, you've got, I'm reading here, you've got more than 70 compositions in total for the Future is Female project.
Right.
But how did you put them all together for the recordings?
So I out of the 70 or so, I chose 30. First of all, my goal was to include a diverse mix of music from composers around the globe. And it was important to include, you know, composers of color and different generations, and starting, you know, representing each era was very important to me, and also works that needed to be recorded that in many cases hadn't been recorded before. So I was less interested in if I'm trying to think if there are any of these works that have been recorded a lot, but works that I felt needed to be recorded. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it just barely scratches the surface. So it could very well be a completely different set of 30 pieces, but also the label First Hand Records is in the UK, and they were especially interested in having one composer from the UK on each album, like Madeline Dring and her Color Suite from 1963. And Deirdre Gribben is on the first album, and she was born in Northern Ireland and now lives in London. So, and just pieces that I felt needed to be recorded, like Agi Yambor, Hungarian, best known as a pianist, and survived World War II under harrowing circumstances, and wrote this sonata dedicated to the victims of Auschwitz. And hers is just an incredible story. So, you know, the only person who had ever played it was Agi Yambor herself, but this hasn't been played, and I felt it really needed to be recorded. So that's sort of my goal. I mean, Gabriel Ortiz, I think, is one of our greatest living composers. Gustavo Dudamel is a great advocate, and her works are being played more and more. But her Prelude and Etude Number 3, I think, should be on every young pianist should play these pieces. And they're great competition pieces. And instead of the same old competition pieces, instead of another Liszt Transcendental Etude, like, play Gabriel Ortiz Prelude and Etude Number 3. They're fabulous, and they really deserve a lot more performances. So that was basically it, I think.
Well, there's an advantage to also taking, you know, in a competition or audition situation, taking to them something that they may not be familiar with, because you are presenting the first version of it that they've ever heard.
Exactly.
Yeah. So if you make a mistake, nobody knows, right?
Well, it's true, but it's also a risk. I think it's also a risk because there's this feeling, I think, in the classical music world, of course, that there's this established way of doing things. And if I've talked with, you know, I've taken this project around the country and talked with students and at all different colleges and universities, and there's this notion that there must be a reason why this repertoire is handed down from generation to generation, and why women are not included in that repertoire, and why, I mean, I'm just curious why it is. So in other words, when a student goes to a competition, that they are going to play a sort of known competition piece like Lowell Lieberman's Gargoyles, that is often done at competitions, rather than take a chance and play Gabriel Ortiz Etude Number 3. Yeah. You know what I mean? That it's like, you have to take a risk if you're going to play something different. But I want to do my small part to just, for some slight cultural shift. And, and you know, I also have to say that, I mean, when students and pianists, touring pianists, continually play programs of all white male composers, which we see more often than not, the thought behind it is that they imagine that that's a neutral position, that they aren't making a statement in any way, and it's completely neutral, but in fact, it's not neutral at all. So that's a conscious choice to exclude music that is readily available, but they choose to ignore it. So I think that's, yeah.
Yeah. You talked about bringing this in front of audiences, and not just in a pedagogical sense, but also, you know, to audiences that are maybe unfamiliar with a lot of this music. How has the reaction been for you in your live performances of this project?
I mean, generally very good. I don't think I've had a bad reaction. I've seen some things online where, like, I was playing at the Barbican in London, and I saw some comments that said, you know, this is pigeonholing, they're right in a way that the ultimate goal is to integrate all these different composers, as it's wonderful that the San Francisco Symphony is doing it, the LA Philharmonic is doing it, and that that's, we shouldn't necessarily have to call attention to, you know, say these are important women composers, but we're not there yet. And so my goal is to sort of highlight these composers. So how has the reaction been? I think what's great, what's been especially great for me, is when I play these programs as a marathon, like 6 hours or 8 hours. I've done it. I played it at the Barbican in London for 6 hours, and the Berkeley Art Museum for 8 hours. And I've been doing that, just playing all this music as a sort of immersion. And showing that there's, it's again, just like barely, you know, that there's so much more. And this is just a very small fraction of what's out there. But there are people who stay for the entire time. And that to me is very meaningful and tells me a lot. And they always have favorite pieces. So that's important to me.
I'm interested in the journey that's portrayed on the album. You know, where does it end? You've talked about this a little bit. Maybe when we get to the point where you don't have to advocate for female composers anymore, you'll sort of have reached, you know, parity for the female composers compared to, you mentioned, the white male composers. Most of them are dead white male composers, right? So where do you see the journey taking us as a whole, as people who listen to classical music, people who make classical music?
Right. I think it really has to start with the music itself, so that if you don't think that Leocadia Kasparova's Osendula Natur is a great piece of music, then there's no point. I mean, in other words, the music needs to speak for itself. So it's not a question of, we have to include a female composer on our concert program. It's more, we need a really great piece of music. Let's look further than what's been handed down to us, and let's do a little extra thinking and investigation and research. And, you know, it's also great that there are resources now, like the Women's Philharmonic Advocacy and Hildegard Publishing and the Luna Composition Lab, that encourages young women and, you know, female identifying composers. And so there are many more resources than there were even when I started this project. But the goal, I don't know if in my lifetime there's going to be parity and equity in programming, but that's a great goal to think about. And I just want to do my part. So when I teach at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music, if I can introduce pianists, young pianists there, to some of these compositions and encourage them to perform them rather than the same old, I mean, in other words, you know, we all love Bach and Beethoven and Mozart, and those are the greatest composers ever, and Schubert, and that's not in question. But there are so many lesser composers that we hear. I mean, why do we hear more Hummel rather than, you know, Teresa Carreño? Like, why is that? I don't know. But it's, or Nikolai Metner. I mean, nothing against Metner, but why Metner and not Germaine Taillefer? Or any number of examples like that.
I'm glad to say that I'm more of a Taillefer fan than I am a Metner fan.
I'm glad to hear it.
But I think the biggest hurdle is just the unfamiliarity factor, that people that haven't heard it or haven't been exposed to it, they're afraid of something that they don't necessarily know. What would you say to somebody who looks at a recording like this, The Future is Female, and they look at the back and they see a few names that they're familiar with, but a lot of new names? How would you encourage them to give it a shot?
Yeah, I would say be open to trying new things. And again, this isn't trying to replace the Haydn string quartets, but it's adding to one's, you know, it's adding to your horizons, and it's sort of just being open. And I think, you know, you asked me about what reaction I've gotten at concerts of this music. And one of the main reactions is people coming up and saying, I love that piece by Leocadia Kasparova, and it's a great discovery. And where can I get the score? And where can I find out more about her? And so that's the ultimate goal, I think, is that, you know, to introduce some of this music, which surprises people who were open to it. And it's not difficult music. I mean, these are pieces written in 1910 and, you know, 1893, and it's a lot of it is older music that is romantic and early 20th century, and I think people will like it.
The album is called The Future is Female, Volume 2. There are three volumes in total. The third one is yet to come. Pianist Sarah Cahill, what would you suggest that we listen to, first-time listener to this album?
Oh, what an interesting question. Maybe the Germaine Taillefer Partita.
Pianist Sarah Cahill talking to me by Zoom, if you couldn't tell. And I want to thank you for making time for our listeners today.
It's wonderful to talk with you. Thank you so much.